Committee will come to order. A quorum is present. Clerk will note the roll. Representative Burrell moves approval of the minutes of the 45th meeting, of the Tax Committee, which occurred on Thursday, February 26, 2004. As many as are in favor of that motion, say aye. Aye. Those opposed, say no. Motion prevails. The first two bills on the agenda are very similar. Representative Atkins moves that House File 2048 be recommended to pass and considered for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Representative Paulson, welcome back to the Tax Committee. Why'd you get off?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I missed my tenure here, believe me, Chair.
We'll have you back, Representative Paulson. We're now at 28 members. I think it's an all-time record, but there's always another chair or two around the table.
Mr. Chair and members, thank you for letting me take a few moments today before you. I think what you'll hear is you'll hear from some of the testifiers today. There really is a compelling story here of how two strangers came to know each other through an organ donation and how one man gave hope and a better life to another. And the legislation before you, which we're calling the Gift of Life Act, is really going to be a heartwarming story that can hopefully be duplicated again and again here in Minnesota. And there are going to be some very important people and testifiers to come forward and share their story. And I want to thank Representative Atkins as well, who has been working on parallel legislation of similar. I think we share the same goals here, it sounds like, the way this has come together. And I know he as well has a personal connection with some folks who have a personal story to tell, and I want to thank him because this is going to be a truly bipartisan effort moving this legislation forward. Essentially, members, the legislation will help those people from suffering financially by giving the gift of life through an organ donation to others. The bill allows an income tax traction of up to $10,000 for travel, for lodging, for lost wages related to human organ donation for transplantation given by a living donor. So individuals who donate all are part of their liver, their pancreas, their kidney, their intestine, lung, or bone marrow would qualify. Mr. Chair and members, people who literally put their lives on hold to save the lives of others should not have to endure more than some of the physical pain that they have to endure. And certainly as lawmakers, we can't help alleviate that donor's pain, but we can and should help some of those lifesavers recoup some of the out-of-pocket costs that do pile up. And so with that, Mr. Chairman, I'm going to turn this over to Dr. John Jarin, a world-renowned transplant surgeon, who is going to start our testimony today, and then from there we'll proceed to some of the folks who really have some heartwarming stories to share.
Dr. Jarin, welcome to the committee. I bring you greetings from one of your former students, Dr. Mark Peskovitz, who runs a transplant program in Indianapolis. But I talked to him over the weekend, and he said, say hello to Dr. Nigerian.
Well, thank you, Chairman Abrams. Yes, Mark was one of our better students and is running an outstanding program at the University of Indiana. Chairman Abrams and members of the committee, my name is Dr. Nigerian. I'm a transplant surgeon and have performed thousands of transplants in the 40 years of my career. Our transplant program at the University of Minnesota has done now over 9,000 transplants, and over 4,000 of these have been from living donors. And we've used living donors related and unrelated. This is the largest living donor experience in the world. We have emphasized living donor transplants primarily because they function immediately and they are less costly, and the procedure can be done when the recipient is in the best shape for surgery. In addition, by having a living donor transplant, you get the transplant right away. You don't have to, as with a kidney, go on dialysis, hemodialysis, for a period of anywhere up to 4, 5, or 6 years, 3 times a week for 4 hours, a very expensive ordeal, as well as one that is very challenging physically. Our patients are such that they were ready to donate a kidney or any organ, and they, however, have to incur cost of travel, cost of time off from work, and other amounts of money that are not physically related or not related to their actual surgery or to their workup procedure. The donors must travel at least 3 times back to the institution for a workup and then finally for surgery. They also must convalesce following the surgery. For the kidney, this could be 2 to 6 weeks. For other organs, such as the liver or the lung, the convalescent period could go on for much longer. And for these donors, a living donation is a very cost-effective thing to do. Because if you consider the other alternative, either waiting for a cadaver kidney, one that could go on, as I stated, for a period of as much as 4, 5, or 6 years, and on dialysis, now they get their organ immediately, and it's a one-time expense with a slight expense there afterwards that differs from an expense over time. This bill has been introduced by Representative Paulson and Senator Scheid, will take some of the disincentives out of this particular thing for the donor, so that costs that are not covered by the recipient's insurance, costs related to travel, costs related to time off work, would be covered by this bill. We strongly support the bill and feel that it will help immensely to take one of the disincentives away from the donors.
Any questions for Dr. Najarian? Representative Sieben.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Doctor, for being here today. Just this morning, I was watching the Today Show, and I saw a doctor from Johns Hopkins University who was talking about a new drug that is pending FDA approval that would essentially stop, that would make it so that donors would not reject organs as often, thus creating a much larger pool for organ donors and for recipients. So I was just wondering if you could comment on that, or if you know anything about this and how you anticipate this will affect people who are able to get organ transplants and also, you know, people who are able to donate then.
Chairman Abrams and members of the committee, the thing that you're citing here is another immunosuppressive agent. This are drugs that are given to prevent rejection. This will not help us. If anything, in the long run, this makes the situation even a little worse. One of the reasons why people are accumulating in large numbers now waiting to get a transplant is that transplant is so successful. And this, another drug that's being added now, is going to make it even more successful. And as it is more successful, more people go on the list waiting for a transplant. So what this does is it helps people who need a transplant, but as far as taking care of the organ shortage, it doesn't help us at all.
Any further questions for Dr. Najarian? Members, I had a grandfather who was on long-term dialysis for 7 years in the late 70s and early 80s. And I'm not going to go into all the details, but in order to be in dialysis at that point, a shunt was put into his arm. He had to go down to Hennepin, which ran the hemodialysis program at the time 3 days a week. And he had to be very careful and monitor very very carefully his liquid intake. He was literally down to being able to suck shaved ice because he can't take in very much liquid. So the improvement of the quality of life in order to be able to have a kidney transplant as opposed to being on hemodialysis is literally the difference between night and day. And unless you've had a relative have to go through, and at the time when my grandfather was on dialysis, he was not a transplant candidate because of age. I think that's probably changed a little bit in the last 20
years.
It has
changed. We now transplant patients up to in the late 70s, interestingly enough, because immediately transplantation is better for them than dialysis, as you point out, is not a good quality of life. So this bill, which is a gift of life bill, it's being called now, is really giving them their life back. And the whole idea of transplant is to make life normal for the recipient.
Representative Brock.
Mr. Chair, thank you, and thank you for your story. I have a story as well. I have a little nephew who's 9 years old who was born with 10% kidney function and who was able to get a transplant down in San Antonio, Texas. I want to thank Dr. Najarian for his research and for what you've done for transplant recipients throughout the years.
Any further questions for Dr. Najarian? Thank you for coming down, sir. Good to see you again. Next name on the list is Keith Vonhorst. No, we don't get very many All-Pros into this place, Mr. Vonhorst. Members of this committee tend to fit into a different category, but welcome to the committee, Mr. Vonhorst, and I see that Mr. Naji is with you, and if I mispronounce your name, I apologize.
Yeah, you did, actually. Naji, that's pretty good.
Okay, great. Mr. Vonhorst, welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the tape.
Thank you. Thank you for the invitation, Chairman Abrams. My story, I discovered I had kidney disease back in the mid-70s. I actually was playing ball and got hit in the kidney and ruptured my kidney. And they did some x-rays and they said, yeah, you ruptured your kidney. That's going to heal. But we noticed a bunch of cysts. And at the time, I found out that I had polycystic kidney disease, which is hereditary. I did not know it at the time, but discovered later my mother had it, my brother has it, and one brother and one sister does not have it, but there's always a chance my daughters could have it. I have three daughters. After I retired from football, I dropped weight, tried to stay in shape, and monitored my kidney closely, would see the doctor every 6 months, was doing pretty good, and then I ran into a few complications, and the situation deteriorated. About 3 years ago, I found out that I was going to need a kidney transplant or go on dialysis. And so I had wonderful friends who put the word out that I was in need of a kidney transplant, kidney donation. It's hard to go and ask people for a kidney, obviously. It isn't something that comes up in everyday conversation, but the word did get out, and early February of 2 years ago, I was on a business trip to Indianapolis, and my wife and I both knew that somebody was going through the process. Well, several people were going through the final process to see if they could be a donor for me, and we did not know who they were, which is standard practice. They don't let you know. And they won't let you know until the donor or potential donor wants them to let you know. And I was in Indianapolis on a business trip. We got a call from my wife on the cell phone, and she said, "Did your donor call?" And I said, "What do you mean?" And she said, "Well, a guy named Afam called." Mm-hmm. And I said, "No, it wouldn't be Afam. I only met Afam one time at a Bible study class." We were sitting across from each other. He wanted to see my Super Bowl ring, and after I gave it to him, he told me he was a Raider fan. So I tried to grab it down quickly, but I forgave him for that. But seemed like a nice guy and everything, but I thought, you know, there's no way a fam would be willing to give me a kidney. I didn't know him. I got a call waiting on my cell phone at the time, and it was a fam. And he said, "Keith, I decided to give you one of my kidneys." And after saying thank you, hopefully enough times, many times, I called him back a short time later and I said, "You weren't kidding, were you?" And he said, "Of course not." And I said, "Well, I just wanted to thank you one more time, but how can you thank somebody for that type of gift?" And so about 3 weeks later, we were at the University of Minnesota, and Dr. Najarian performed surgery on Afam and I, and the kidney's working great. We just got past the one-year anniversary. And so the kidney's working great. And this type of bill, if it can do anything to help ease some of the trials and tribulations that the donor has to go through, because it's a tough process, it's a tough recovery. In fact, they told me right away it's a lot tougher on the donor. The recovery is a lot tougher on the donor than the recipient, because the recipient is feeling great because he's just got a new kidney that's working. I remember laying in the hospital 2 days after surgery thinking, haven't felt this good in 5-10 years. Meanwhile, Fom was about 2 floors down. He wasn't feeling all that great, but he wasn't looking for sympathy. So, you know, to consider this type of to help for a donor is tremendous, and I hope that you can do everything you can.
Bob Najee,
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Afam Naji. I'm not going to go for sake of time. I'm not going to go into the details of how the whole thing happened because it's a very long story. But one thing I like about this bill is the fact that families go through a lot of hardship and a lot of pressure trying to decide if this is good in the interest of your family. The only thing I can say is, as a Christian, when I was presented with an opportunity like this, obviously, I prayed about it, and it's not often that you pray and God answers your prayer just like that. And I prayed about it, and then like a couple of weeks later, I was laid off my work, and it's like, you know, you don't have any choice right now, and you either do it or you don't talk about it no more. So we proceeded and went ahead with it, but I just want to emphasize that there's tremendous amount of pressure and difficulties that, you know, families go through in terms of child care if you have kids, in terms of transportation and other things that your medical insurance is not going to be able to cover. And it's not an incentive here, really. It's not an incentive for people to go out and start being an organ donor, but it's, like Dr. Najarian said, it's a disincentive. You know, you want people to make sure that all the bases are covered, that there isn't any really out-of-pocket expenses, you know, in terms of being able to help save someone's lives. And for my situation, my wife was put on bed rest. She was on bed rest for 17 weeks with pregnancy complications. And I have a 2.5-year-old boy, and didn't have work for 9 months. And you can imagine the tremendous amount of pressure that we all felt in our families trying to do what we consider the right thing to save a life. So I think that, you know, any bill that will go in a long way trying to help people alleviate some of the problems that you're going to face, especially financial problem, it's something that I'm 110% behind. Thank you.
Any questions for either Mr. Fonhorst or Mr. Naji? Representative Mullery.
Just a quick one, not pertaining to the credit. Does Jim have the same problem?
Fonhorst. I'm sorry, I really...
Oh, you don't want to...
Yeah. But potentially you could have the same problem, yeah.
Any further questions for either Representative Atkins?
Thank you, Mr. Fonhorst, Mr. Naji. I just wanted to commend you for coming here today and telling your story. My real question is, Fonhorst, do you find yourself rooting for the Raiders now?
You know, there are some things that change a little bit. All of a sudden I came out of surgery and I always wanted to get nice steaks when we went out to dinner, and I'd never have steaks before. My wife said, "What's going on?" She called the phone. She said, "Do you like steak?" And he said, "Yeah, I love it." And she thought, "Oh." And so far, there haven't been other things that have shown up.
Believe it, he likes dancing now, actually.
It hasn't helped that a bit. I was hoping it would.
Thank you both.
Representative Lincheski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you for sharing that story. I turned to Representative Lanning and I said, boy, it sure makes you feel small when you hear someone who did what you did. And that's just a great story. I do want to thank Representative Paulson for bringing this forward. And, you know, I feel like I should mention that former Representative Darlene Luther, who has passed away, this was her issue. And she carried lots of legislation, as we all know, on this. And I know a lot of her friends are here. They worked hard with her on this. And she got the LifeSource mobile unit, and I see some of those people here today. She worked hard to make sure that state employees could have a week off to give an organ. And in fact, I hope that those who've shown an interest today as legislators, Representative Atkins and Representative Paulson, that you'll consider looking at that, because that is scheduled to sunset this year. And so that is another issue that the state had been a leader on with Representative Luther, that she fought to help facilitate organ donors, and we're going to see that sunset this year. So I wanted to mention her because I know that the community who's in the room has worked with her for many, many years, and I'm really happy to see that Representative Paulson has taken that on, and I appreciate that.
Thank you for reminding us about that, Representative Lincheski. With, you know, due respect to Representative Nelson and former Representative Jordan, I would give anything to still be serving with Representative Luther. Any further questions? Mr. Fonhorst, Mr. Naji, thank you for coming forward. Very nice to meet both of you. Mr. Andrew Anderson is next on the list.
Good Chairman Abrams and the committee members. It's good to be here today. I see some old friends from when I was living up in Fargo-Moorhead, and delightful to have an opportunity to speak with you about...
You're on the Moorhead side, right, Mr. Anderson?
Yes.
Just checking that out.
Yes. When Mayor Lanning, of course, was making things happen up there.
City was never run better, was it?
Great job. I was the recipient 4 years ago of a non-directed donor's kidney. The gentleman that donated the kidney lives in Westerly, Rhode Island. It involved several trips, two trips to Minnesota to do the workup and the various other pieces of medical and psychological assessment that are done when a donor comes forward. I had five friends and two siblings that had offered kidneys, but for various reasons were not matches and were not good options for donation. When Mr. Philip Goodwin came forward, he requested that he remain anonymous at that time, and that we went for 2 years without knowing. After we did meet 2 years ago, we've continued to have a very delightful friendship, obviously. And in that process of coming to know him, I began to hear some of the story about what was involved. Not necessarily from the medical point of view, because I was fairly aware of that from my previous experience with persons who had gone through transplants, both donations and recipients, but the costs that were involved in terms of travel, lodging, for the trips that he made to come to Minnesota. At the time, University of Minnesota and Johns Hopkins were the only two places in the country that would do non-directed, non-related donors. Since that time, almost every transplant center, I believe now, is doing that type of organ transplant from non-directed donors as well as directed donations. That whole area of talking about what insurance companies cover, we're blessed with very fine, I was blessed with very fine insurance that covered, of course, all of my costs for the medical procedures, and, of course, Mr. Goodwin's costs for his medical procedures related to donating his kidney. However, the cost of loss of work, job loss during that time, the loss of the costs of travel and the costs of the lodging and other pieces were not covered. Now, this bill, of course, would not impact Mr. Goodwin because he's a resident of Rhode Island. But for individuals who may be interested in this state, since most of the transplant centers, three of them are in the Twin Cities area, and one, of course, is in Rochester at Mayo, the people that are in greater Minnesota would have that cost of travel also incurred. This bill does address some of those costs, possibilities for recovery. Your support of the bill and your encouragement of the people that have made this decision is very greatly appreciated. I am now celebrating the fourth anniversary this week of a very successful transplant. Life has been full and rich. I continue to do things that I had to discontinue, teaching a high school Sunday school class, serving as chairperson of the board at my parish. I've been involved in politics significantly, and also have continued to be involved in community organizations and such. All of those have been put on hold because of the limitations that came with the kidney disease that was a part of my life. Knowing full well what dialysis is about, my mother was on dialysis for 13 years, one of the longer stints on dialysis for persons, and was knowing full well what that involved. I was blessed not to have to go on dialysis because of the donor that came forward. And the program that the University of Minnesota and was a part of in terms of being on the very forefront, the cutting edge of non-directed donor programs. So thank you for your consideration and for the opportunity to testify before you in support of this particular piece of legislation.
Any questions for Mr. Anderson? Representative Marquardt.
Well, it's great to see thank you, Mr. Chair. It's great to see Mr. Anderson here. And I have to tell you, he was on in Dilworth, the chairperson of our planning commission in Dilworth. So, and we were going around, just one quick story. He was also a pastor at the Lutheran Church. And we were going around showing a slideshow to the various realtors of Dilworth. And during one presentation, as we were going to talk about downtown Dilworth, he had slipped in two slides of ancient Jerusalem in there. And the mayor didn't know about anyone else, but it was, but it's great to see you here today, and it's great that this bill is being brought forward, but appreciate that.
Mr. Chair, I believe the one slide was a picture of a camel. We were suggesting that the possibility of mass transit dromedary transportation, we were discussing.
Yeah, it was a great presentation that day, Mr. Chair, so thank you.
Any further questions for Mr. Anderson? Thank you very much for coming forward, sir. And who is next?
Thank you, Chairman and members of the committee. Hello, my name is Melissa Roberts, and I am a full-time social worker for Hennepin County. I am a full-time PhD student at the University of Minnesota. I am a mother of a very busy 11-year-old boy. And the reason I am here before you is that I am also a donor of a kidney to my mother this past May. I am here today to ask that you consider and do everything possible to remove all barriers for future donors. The decision to give my mom as a kidney was really simple. It was a no-brainer. You know, my mom, I want her to live. Not a lot of choice in that. However, I then was faced with the reality of how am I actually going to do this? I knew that I would need 6 weeks off of work minimally to recover. I didn't have enough vacation or sick time accrued to do that. I knew that I would need to make arrangements for my son to provide for his care. And I knew that I would need to pay for my mortgage, my tuition, other bills, basic needs like food, those sorts of things. Fortunately for me, my job allowed me to receive donations of time from my coworkers. And although those donations don't equal the amount of pay that I would receive as working full-time, it definitely helped to offset costs. Also, I took advantage of the bill that was mentioned by Representative Lenteski.
You can buy a vowel.
because I'm a county employee, I'm also allowed to take advantage of what state employees receive in terms of the full week of pay, paid leave. And then also, I was able to apply for and receive a grant from the Transplant Center of $500, which helped greatly in covering costs during that time. I was fortunate that I didn't have some of the costs that other donors have had in terms of travel expenses and paying for accommodation. So I guess in conclusion, what I would say is this. Had I not received the assistance from my job, you know, in terms of the donations from coworkers, had I not received support from family and friends who stepped in and provided the care of my son during the time that I needed to recover, and had I not received the benefits from the state in terms of paid leave time and the grant from the Transplant Center, I would not have been able to give the gift of life to my mother.
Any questions for Ms. Roberts? Thank you very much. You must be Cheryl Jacobs. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself at the table.
Well, thank you. And I'd like to first thank Representative Paulson for introducing this bill and Chairman Abrams and the committee for the opportunity to present today. I am a clinical social worker with the Living Donor Program at Fairview University Medical Center, where Melissa, I think, is a real social worker. I have more of a different type of position where she's in the trenches. However, in that role, I have the opportunity to interview potential living donors to not only assess their psychological well-being and making sure that they're not feeling pressure and that they're comfortable with such a big decision to donate a kidney, a liver, or a lung, and some of the other organs. But at that same time, I question their employment and financial situation to see if they can simply afford to do this. And I can tell you that the out-of-pocket expenses, which you've heard from our previous donors, are related to travel, to lodging, to the meals while they're there, the parking. And this is all during their evaluation, which could be up to 3 days, depending on the organ. For lung donation, it's 3 days. and during the hospitalization, and then during the recovery, which can take up to 6 weeks. And this depends on the type of job responsibilities they have. Obviously, if it's more physically intensive, they'll need the full 6 weeks. So this determines how long they'll need for recovery, as well as their physical well-being. One of the studies that we did several years ago indicated that donors paid an average of $569 out of pocket for expenses, and that's excluding lost wages. So that's just in those other costs alone, such as travel. And many of the donors use a combination of benefits, and the majority, about half, used sick leave or sick time. And interestingly enough, 34% of the donors used savings. And typically vacation time and sick leave don't add up to the 6 weeks, as we know. And if people do have short-term disability, they usually have to be off for 3 to 6 weeks before that even begins. So many of the donors don't even have that option. And disability typically pays 60% of that income, so they aren't able to use that. So donors depend on their family members and others to assist them. And many of our donors are self-employed or may work for smaller businesses, so don't have any of the aforementioned benefits to use. And again, I'd like to thank the legislature that passed in 2001 the state leave benefit of allowing paid leave for 5 days. And I think we've had roughly five donors be able to use that benefit since it was passed. But many donors, potential donors, choose to not donate because they simply can't afford it. In one study, roughly 25% of family members decided not to donate because they simply couldn't afford it. And I think that's a significant number to remember. And we've had many inquiries about complete strangers, as Mr. Anderson mentioned, where the people just come and decide that they want to volunteer to a complete stranger and then have declined when they find that they have to incur some of those costs. And the recipient's insurance does only cover the medical aspects of the donor evaluation. It does not pay for any of the lost wages or the direct costs of travel and so forth. So as a result of that, our program has established a donor assistance fund, and which can help with out-of-pocket expenses. There is a cap at $500, which doesn't touch, as you know, most of the expenses, because we just felt that people shouldn't have to pay to donate an organ, and we can't reimburse for lost wages. Some of our donors have asked whether they could deduct these expenses, and unfortunately we've been able to say no, not at this time. And so a tax deduction would not be an incentive or an enticement to donate, but it's rather a way to recognize, I think, the sacrifice and the contribution that these individuals make to a recipient, but also society as a whole, and they shouldn't have to pay to donate. So I thank you for your potential support.
Any questions for Ms. Jacobs? Oh, Representative Dempsey. Sorry, Chairman Dempsey.
Ms. Jacobs, I'm just reading a little bit of information in regard to the solution to the problem, and I'm reading it says, according to Driver and Vehicle Services, 1,791,968,000 Minnesotans have donor marked on their driver's license. Now, that's almost half of the state. How many more is needed to fulfill the demand for organ transplant? Could you help me with that?
I will certainly.
Ms. Jacobs.
Try to do that, Mr. Chair. Well, when someone signs up to be a potential donor, first of all, the circumstances also must be just so that they're able to be what we call a deceased donor at the time of death. And not their medical situation has to be where they have brain death and their organs are viable to donate. So that's and Dr. Najarian can probably address this better than I can in terms of what percentage actually go on to donate. But they have to be a match to a particular recipient. And we know that recipients, depending on the type of organ, still continue to wait for organs anywhere from 3 to 5 years. So those recipients may not be a match for those individuals who could potentially donate if the circumstances were right.
And then a follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Representative Dempsey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And passing this piece of legislation with the finances attached, from your perspective, will this be an incentive for more donors?
Mr. Chair, thank you. No, I believe it will not be any type of incentive, since individuals have already approached us about donating. And as in Ms. Roberts' case, I mean, she would continue to donate, but it's easing the financial burden and the consequence of donating. And as just as a tax deduction, it's still not reimbursing them any funds for what they've actually lost. So they still have to pay for daycare and their lost wages, but it would be a tax deduction. So I believe this bill will not entice or increase the donations, other than it might be another benefit that one could see of, okay, this might be a potential thing that I could do, since I'll be able to have a tax deduction. And it's a way to recognize, I think, the sacrifice and contribution that these individuals are doing, but it's not a reimbursement.
Representative Burrell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a comment and then a question for Ms. Jacobs. When my brother needed a bone marrow transplant, all 10 of his living siblings were tested, and only my sister from Colorado matched identically. All of us were willing to donate. However, she needed to move from Colorado to here for a little over 3 weeks and go through all that process. My question, I guess, actually is, since the rest of us were tested, are we in a database somewhere? So if someone needs bone marrow, are we only selected for a specific instance, or are we available? How would we make that test available to other people that might need bone marrow?
Ms. Jacobs.
Mr. Chair, and my understanding is you can become a registered bone marrow donor through the blood center here at within Minneapolis. So at that time, you would indicate whether or not you'd like to be a registered bone marrow for a complete stranger that might need it and become a part of that bank.
Any further questions for Ms. Jacobs? Thank you. The next testifier was on Representative Atkins' bill, but I think it'd be appropriate for her to testify at this time. Victoria Sadek, and I apologize, Victoria, if I have mispronounced your last name, but welcome to the committee. Please
identify yourself. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It is Sadek.
Sadek.
Thank you. Thank you to the chairman, the members of the committee, for allowing us to be here. I would like to especially thank Representative Atkins for his invitation, Representative Paulson for allowing us to testify. I'm here today with my son, Bart Rawl. I think you were just handed an article that appeared in this morning's Star Tribune about Bart and his brother, Adam. I believe Bart is here by the grace of God, modern technology, and wonderful doctors, as you heard testify earlier. In March of 2002, Bart was diagnosed with acute myelogenous leukemia. This diagnosis came one day after his brothers participated in a state wrestling tournament. And I must apologize for our attire or the lack thereof, but we are headed to a wrestling tournament. And I'm sorry, that was more important to me than putting on a dress. But we're both feeling a little ashamed that we have wrestling attire on. But the day after the state tournament, Bart was not feeling well, and I said, as a mom, just do me a favor and go down and have him check you out and tell me that it's nothing and I don't have to worry. Within an hour, the doctor called and said he needs to be hospitalized now. It's serious, and within 24 hours, the diagnosis of acute myelogenous leukemia was pronounced. Bart underwent several rounds of chemotherapy, was declared to be in remission, and was in so for 18 months when the cancer reoccurred. He was again hospitalized, again given chemotherapy, and told that we can probably get you back into remission at this time, but if you do not have a bone marrow transplant, chances are this will keep reoccurring and eventually come back and take your life. I'm sorry, Representative, what is your name, sir? Burrell. Your comments really hit home with us. Bart's three siblings were tested. Only one of them, his 18-year-old brother Adam, was declared to be a perfect match, 6-for-6 criteria. And if you read this article, this all came up during football season and now during wrestling season. And Adam was very willing to do this regardless of what would happen to his athletic career. And make note, he's going to be state champion this year. 160 pounds. Okay, Henry Sibley High School. What we have learned through this entire process is Bart is very fortunate and has been obviously a lot out of the hospital, and he has to go back in almost every day for lab checkups, and in I think a couple of weeks we'll have a bone marrow biopsy to determine if things are going as well as we hope they are. But what we have noticed is not only are our costs astronomical through this, we're talking about $500,000, much of it not covered under insurance since Bart's too old to be under my insurance, even though he's still living at home and a full-time student. But also, since the donor is also part of my family, we're dealing with the expenses incurred there. Obviously, he's only 18, he's a high school senior, but I can only imagine what the expenses would be for someone that has to take off work, find daycare, travel. Many of the people in Bart's wing in the hospital were from outstate Minnesota or out of state, and they literally had to find lodging and deal with food and expenses of being away from their family and child care and you name it. This bill, I think, would, I guess I disagree with one of the last testifiers that I do think it may help be an incentive for someone to donate if they know that some of those little expenses are not going to be a hindrance to them. If that's the thing that puts them over, then so be it. And I really support this bill, and I hope you do too, because I think it offers at least one more piece of the puzzle to offer a piece of life to someone. And I'll let Bart make comments.
I'd like to make
welcome
comment.
Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the tape.
My name is Bart Rawl. I'd like to make a comment to what you said, your question earlier. If there is a donor list, there is a national bone marrow donor list out there, and each and every person in this room could be a possible donor for somebody else. That really is a simple test of. I didn't go through the test, obviously, but my three siblings did, and I don't think it was more than an hour. They drew some blood, did some simple tests, and found out that my younger brother was a donor. And I'd also like to mention that for a bone marrow transplant donor, I think the word transplant scares a lot of people about doing it. Like I said earlier, each and every person in this room could be a possible donor. And for a transplant, really, for most of it, it doesn't take, you might know, sir, that it's not something that you're losing, like a kidney or a lung. Really, all involved for my brother was doing some workup, some tests, and he sat in a chair and had an IV in one arm. Blood came out, went through a machine, took out what I needed, went back and threw another IV into his other arm. He was tired for a couple days, went back to school. He did that on Thursday. I got the donation Thursday night. He went back to school on Monday. He's been fine ever since. So I think the word transplant, scares a lot of people as far as, oh, I don't want to do that, you know. So I encourage you, encourage everyone to get tested to help save someone else's life for a bone marrow transplant. And if that doesn't interest you, to at least get out and give blood, because I know that the country's the blood that's used for in ERs and whatnot for people that receive blood is only given by 5% of the country. So I encourage you, everyone, to get out there and give blood.
Mr. Chairman?
Ms. Savick.
I also want to just add then that I'm a high school teacher, and it's been amazing to me through this process how many of my students and colleagues have decided to become donors of some sort. And I will say that they are doing it out of, I guess, the goodness of their heart and because they believe it's the right thing to do. But a number of them have asked about the cost. And so with this bill addressing those out-of-pocket expenses, I think it would just be really critical that you take a serious look at this and do the right thing to try and help people. If you read our article, you know, we've received a lot of press on this. Randy Shaver, a cancer survivor, did a wonderful piece on the boys a week or so ago, maybe you saw on Care 11. Bob Sansevier did a piece in the St. Paul Pioneer Press a few weeks ago and is going to do a follow-up article. And our message has always been that it isn't about the boys as much as it is we want people to help other people. So if you can do that through this bill by offering some kind of assistance to take away that last little hindrance for people to be willing to do that, it would be greatly appreciated. Thank you, sir.
Any questions for Ms. Sadek or Mr. Rao? Art, really good luck to you.
Thank you.
Next
Thank
week.
You. We're going to the Excel now.
Appreciate that.
Well, I hate to bring us back to what is our job in the tax committee, but I do want to ask the staff a couple questions. In one of the pieces of literature, there is a proposed federal law, the Donation Recovery Act, S-573. Has anybody from the staff had an opportunity to look at that and how this would dovetail, and would it be possible to draft something so that if the federal law passed, we wouldn't need a separate subtraction and it would happen automatically? Have you looked at that issue, Nina? If you could you look at that? And I also have asked, because we have about 20 credits before this committee and who knows how many deductions and subtractions, what the tax form would look like. This is one that obviously is, if not at the top, very near the top of my list. So I'm going to want to talk to the department about what form would look like and what the instructions and how it would be administered so that we don't run into some of the same problems we've run into in the past in a couple of other areas, because if we're going to do it for these folks, I want to make sure that we do it right. Representative Pugh.
Mr. Chair, just thinking, if you have a young donor who doesn't have employment, this doesn't really help at all. Is that, am I thinking this through right? The family may have, the parents may have paid for the travel, the lodging, but the subtraction from income wouldn't be available to a young donor who doesn't have enough income perhaps to file.
Ms. Manzi, the wonderful world of how deductions work for dependents. Could you talk about that a little bit for Representative Pugh?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Pugh, I think you're reading it correctly in the case of most dependents. Most dependents are probably not going to have income of their own and not have a filing requirement, so the deduction would not benefit them for their medical expense, for their travel and lodging expenses, and they wouldn't have any lost wages.
Mr. Chairman,
Representative Pugh,
would the parent be able to claim the deduction or subtraction?
Ms. Manzi, isn't that a it depends sort of answer?
Mr. Chairman, that's probably correct. I brought with me the federal instructions. These expenses are allowed, the travel and lodging expenses are allowed as a federal itemized deduction as part of the medical expense deduction, but that's only available to the extent a person's expenses exceed 7.5% of their adjusted gross income, and then that would then also only be available to those who claim the itemized deduction. And I don't, when I read through this, I didn't look to see if the lodging expenses count for an individual who's donating an organ for a transplant, but I didn't read it closely to see if it would count for a parent whose child was donating something. And I can try to look at that here and also look at it and get the information to you later if I can't.
And I think, Ms. Manzi, the information regarding the possible congressional action may resolve this question. because if it becomes a subtraction for federal income tax purposes for dependents, and we dovetail this with federal law, then you have it covered, which is why I asked the question to begin with, which is, you know, we don't want to have a mismatch. First, I think we probably want to do something like this. It's a question of how you jigger it and how you work with the department. But secondly, we want to coordinate with the federal government so that if we can eliminate the complexity, we can. So if you can do a little bit of work and get back to Representative Paulson, Representative Adkins, Representative Hugh, and myself and other committee members, I think that would be very helpful. Any further questions? Does anybody in the audience wish to testify either in favor or opposed to House File 2048? At this point, the chair will lay over House File 2048 for further consideration and possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Thank you very much, Representative Paulson and guests.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Okay. The chair is going to bring back House File 2048 because there was a DE2 amendment which we did not adopt. Representative Adkins moves the DE2 amendment to put the bill into at least a more progressed state than it was introduced. Right. As many as are in favor of that motion say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed say no. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. The chair at this time will lay over House File 2048 as amended for further consideration, possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Okay, for highlights for next week, we're going to go on to the policy bill next. There are two other issues which are being teed up for probably Tuesday and Thursday of next week, and probably a third if the administration is in a position to act. The two issues that are going to be before the committee next week will be the single factor sales issue, which we'll take first. There's probably 8 or 10 bills. We'll take one as a vehicle to get the discussion, have a little bit of overview, and then have witnesses for and against. Then there'll be the alternative minimum tax issue. There's a bill that I have in that members are free to sign on to, which does two things. It over time increases the threshold and also eliminates the floor on the charitable contributions. I understand that there may be some controversy, so you may want to see the income breakdown of that before we do it, but I did want to bring the issue of the state AMT before the committee, and that bill will be a vehicle for the discussion. I don't know if we're going to have any money to do very much with it, but I think that it's a important discussion to have. And then if the department and the administration is ready, the supplemental
guilty, Your Honor.
30 days in the Freeborn County Jail for you, Dorman. Mr. Manson, if the administration is ready with the supplemental, we're certainly ready to start hearing the supplemental next week. And then I'll be coordinating with Representative Pugh to try to give you the DFL members of the committee a few days head start as to where we're heading so that we're not trying to hide anything or trying to do drive-by bills. But that's basically where we are. The other issue is that it is fast coming upon the time where if you have a TIF bill or if you have a public finance bill and you wish it to be considered this year, please, please, please get it in. The TIF forms are available at the office of Blair Tremere. The TIF working group, again, will consist of Representatives Lincheski, Atkins, Abrams, and Jacobson. And don't try the routine, some of you lobbyists, of getting it stuck into the Senate bill and think that you are somehow bypassing the House, because as all the members of the working group can attest, when those provisions do arise, we subject those provisions to the same test that we subject the original provisions to. So, word to the wise. With that, we will now call up House File 2552, the policy bill. And Chair will move that it be considered for possible include be recommend pass considered for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. And I take it that the in members packet there is the A04-1017 amendment. Is that, Joel, the latest iteration of what we're working on? Or is that an amendment to the bill? I think that's an amendment to the bill, isn't it, Joel? Okay. Why don't we take the bill first? Joel, should we take the bill first and then work on the amendments? I think yes. that because there's separate issues in the amendments that have come up through the staff, and I think that we'll deal with those separately from the bill itself.
There's three amendments.
So at this time, I see Teresa is here. Are you going to lead the department's presentation? Teresa Mitchell, welcome back to the committee. And please identify yourself for the tape.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Teresa Mitchell, Director of Legal Services at the Department of Revenue. We're going to be going through our department's policy bill. These are what I would characterize as fairly minor policy provisions generally, but that are not so technical as to be appropriate for the department's technical bill, which we heard earlier. The bill covers withholding, sales, property, and some administrative provisions, including some cleanup to the jobs and biotech legislation that passed last session, some tweaking as we find little glitches with the law as we start to administer it. As you can see by the handouts, there is no cost to this bill or the corresponding amendments. The attorneys from the department's legal staff will be running through the provisions and hopefully answering any questions. And then, I guess, on to the amendments.
Mark Peterson, welcome back to the committee. Please identify yourself for the tape.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. My name is Mark Peterson. I'm an attorney with the department. I'll go through Article 1 of the bill. Sections 1 and 3 of the bill change the date that the department has to pay interest on refunds payable to businesses under the Border City Development Zone and Biotechnology and Health Science Zone programs.
That's a technical change to correlate with the other sales tax exemption refund, am I correct?
Mr. Chairman, it corresponds to the capital equipment.
Any questions? That's Article 1.
Well, there's
Section 2,
Mr. Chairman, makes changes related to obligations of persons who hire a contract with non-residents to do construction work. In particular, it applies to persons who, in the ordinary course of their business, hire or contract with a non-resident individual or foreign corporation to perform construction work in Minnesota. Under current law, this particular subdivision requires persons who hire the non-resident contractor to withhold 8% of payments to the non-resident if the contract is expected to exceed $100,000. Under the proposed amendment, the section will apply once aggregate payments by the person to the non-resident in a calendar year exceed $50,000.
So we're tightening a reporting requirement for or withholding requirement for non-resident construction workers. Is that
yes,
correct?
We are, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Section 3.
Section 3, Mr. Chairman, was I already discussed on the Border City Development Zone, so that is Article 1.
Any questions by members of the committee on Article 1? Article 2, and Mr. Starica is coming from the audience. Welcome back to the committee, Mr. Starica. Please identify yourself for the tape.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Lance Starica with the Department of Revenue. Explain Article 2 of the bill, property taxes. Sections 1 and 2, there's four sections in this article. Sections 1 and 2 have to do with the blind and disabled persons special homestead benefit program. The first section adds the statute that talks about the application for this program to the list of Minnesota tax laws for the purposes of Chapter 270B. You can't see the impact of this from the language in the bill, but what this does is make that application
similar to an income tax return in terms of it being private data and just available only to the person that it has to do with, unless some other exception is provided for in law. And then the second section clarifies that of this application, which will be treated like a tax return for privacy purposes, off of that return we can disclose both the name and the address as well as the identifying numeric number of the parcel involved, when we, so that when we communicate to the counties there aren't any miscommunications about who is qualified and who is. And both of those sections would be effective upon final enactment.
So it's classifying data and it's making it easier for the department to communicate with county assessors.
That's right, Mr. Chair. We have consistently treated this application as if it were private data, like an income tax return, and this law would do that, and it would also clarify, allow us to share more information with the county, in other words, the name and address, along with the digitized parcel ID number, so that we can make sure we're talking about the same person and the same parcel.
Any questions? Section 3.
Section 3 has to do with the fairly recent enacted Sustainable Forest Incentive Act, and it has to do with letting property out of the program in cases of condemnation. That's what the law says now. What we found is that in condemnation situations, they often don't have a court case. They often reach a negotiated settlement with the landowner, and so to require that there be a court case in order to have the land get out from underneath the eight-year or it's a variable length of time, 4 or 8 years takes you to get out of the program normally. So what this says is anybody who acquires property, title or possession, and they had the power to condemn the property, we will let that property out of the program without any penalties. And it also, this section of the bill also clarifies that it's only that part that they acquire that gets out of the program. We don't kick out 10,000 acres because the township acquired a quarter of an acre for a road or something like that.
Mr. Sirica, why is it only the state and local government unit? What if the federal government would exercise its right of eminent domain? Is there a separate provision dealing with that?
Mr. Chair, we tried to cover that in the language on page 5, line 8. Any entity that has the right of eminent
or any domain. Entity, okay. Any other entity, okay. Any questions about Section 3?
That section would be effective the day after final enactment, too. Section 4 is some repealers, very cryptic language in the bill. The 1975 laws that are being referred to have to do with the Alexandria Lake Area Sanitary District that was created under laws of 1975. And the 2003 laws that are referred to have to do with the Central Lakes Region Sanitary District that was created in 2003. And we're repealing very small sections within the laws that enabled these two sanitary districts to be in existence. What it does is eliminate their discretionary authority to levy general property taxes on a different tax base than is normally the case. The special tax base that was provided to these two entities in their enabling legislation includes everything except agricultural properties at 1/4 of their otherwise taxable value. I believe that's the correct details on that. And this would eliminate that option for these two districts. They would still be able to levy taxes, property taxes, but they just would not have the choice of this alternate tax base.
Mr. Sirica, are the authorities in those local, those two sanitary districts informed about this provision, and do they support them?
Mr. Chair, yes, both questions. Okay.
Article 3. Mr. Walzer.
Did you bring the whole department with you today, Jack? You know, if there's a taxpayer who has some problems, is there anybody there to answer the phones? Welcome back to the committee, Mr. Walzer. Please identify yourself for the tape.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Richard Walzer. I'm an attorney with the Department of Revenue. I'm going to be discussing the miscellaneous article with my neighbor sitting next to me. So I'll start by discussing sections 1 through 4. Section 1 is an amendment to the state debt collection chapter, which is 16D, and it transfers the duties of the case reviewer to the taxpayer rights advocate and gives the advocate the power to issue a debtor assistance order just like she would for a taxpayer assistance order. Section 2 is an amendment to the Commissioner of Revenue's Delegations of Authority statute, and it simply says that if one commissioner grants a delegation of authority to a particular employee, that authority would carry over to a successor commissioner. Section 3 is...
Until revoked by the... If a new commissioner didn't like a delegation that the current commissioner made, he could just sign an order and it's revoked. No need to come here. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. Section 3 is a new provision in Chapter 270, which is the Department of Revenue's General Powers chapter, and it basically lifts language that currently exists for mailing tax orders to the taxpayer's last known address, and lifts that language and puts it in Chapter 270 so that this method of sending out notices will have general application. The next section is Section 4, which is an amendment to the state tax lien law. And under current law, tax liens can only be transcribed from one county to another county, and this would allow a transcription to take place from a county to the Secretary of State's office. And I'll turn it over to Mr. Peterson.
Mr. Peterson, biotech zones.
For Section 5, Mr. Chairman, this has to do with the property tax exemption for the qualified businesses in the biotech and health science zone. Clarifies that the property tax exemption that they have is available if as long as the property is occupied by July 1 of the assessment year. That language is consistent with how the jobs program's property tax exemption works.
Back to the
Chairman.
Representative Anderson.
Going back to Section 4, why is that provision necessary?
Mr. Walzer, why is Section 4 necessary? What is the situation that came up that had the Legal Services Department say, we need this change, and the Commissioner saying, yes, we do?
Mr. Chair, Representative, back in the year 2000, the state tax lien law was amended with regard to the rules of where state tax liens are supposed to be perfected. So that prior to 2000, to the year 2000, a tax lien recorded in the office of a county recorder would attach to all property, both real and personal property, of an individual living in that county. But then the rules changed in the year 2000 so that if the department wants to file a tax lien to attach to any kind of personal property, the lien now has to be filed with the Secretary of State's office. So it's because of a change in the rules of perfecting tax liens that took place a few years ago that we're now making this rather technical change.
So basically, Mr. Walzer, this is just a conforming amendment to what the change was in 2000.
Mr. Chair, that's basically correct.
Okay.
Now on to Section 6.
And I'm sure some litigant out there in 5 years is going to take this tape and use that statement against you, but that's okay.
Mr. Chair, you could be right, but okay. Hopefully they aren't listening.
Oh, they will. They're very creative.
Section 6 has to do with the what's known as the divorce spouse liability allocation, and this is a situation where husband and wife are liable for a joint income tax liability. They get divorced, and then under the statute, either spouse has a right to apply to the Department of Revenue for a division of that joint liability into two separate liabilities. So that statute is already in the law. What Section 6 does, it puts a time limit on how far back the department will go in allocating the split. And it provides a 6-year time limit for as to how many tax years you can go back. And also there's a de minimis threshold of having a liability of at least $100 before the allocation will be made.
Mr. Welzer, how is due date defined in this section of law? Because I can think of three due dates. I can think of April 15th, I can think of August 15th, and I can think of October 15th. So what would the due date be?
Mr. Chair, it would be the due date of that the income tax return was due, so it would be April 15th.
Okay. Mina, could you kind of make a note to see how due date is defined elsewhere in the statute? It's a very minor issue, but, you know, because you can get an automatic extension of 4 months and a 2-month extension for cause, I want to make sure that everybody, so that there is a definition of due date in statute in this point. Any questions? Section 7.
Mr. Chairman, Section 7 deals with the research and development expense subtraction that's been in law for, I don't know, maybe 20 years. The subtraction is the amount of research and development expenses that were used to generate the federal research and development credit. But the taxpayers are not allowed to take a subtraction for the amount of the research and development expense credit that they took on their tax return. This change would say that any biotechnology research and development credit that they received under that program would have to be subtracted from the federal research and development expenses and the calculation of that expense. Calculation of that deduction.
Any questions about Section 7? Representative Mullery.
I think I know the answer. I just want to be sure, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Walzer, on Section 4, I'm just wondering, because it says the lien's enforceable from the time the lien arises, which is actually before the could technically be argued before the filing of it. You don't intend to have that lien take priority over, let's say that there was a lien in one county, there's property in another county, you transcribe it to the Secretary of State after a person's purchased it. You don't intend to have that take effect before it's filed in the Secretary of State's office, do you?
Mr. Walzer.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mullery, this wouldn't impact the rules of priority. It would still be whoever records first would win.
Minnesota is a race to the courthouse state for Senator Mallory.
Sections 8 and 9 are Minnesota Care Tax amendments, and I am told that they're technical in nature. To exclude the term blood and blood products from the definition of gross revenues received by wholesale drug distributors for the sale of legend drugs. And this is not a substantive change from the way the law works now. It just makes the exemption at the first level rather than the second level, and it excuse me, and it conforms to federal law.
Sections 10 and 11 change the definition of what a qualified business is for purposes of in Section 10, the job opportunity building zones, and for Section 11, the biotech and health science zones. Under both those programs, businesses are required to enter into business subsidy agreements. And what these two changes will do is to assure that no business can claim any tax exemptions if they have not, in fact, complied with a business subsidy agreement or, in fact, have even entered into a business subsidy agreement. So this is almost a technical change just to assure that no taxpayers try to make the argument that they're entitled to the exemptions even if they haven't signed the business subsidy agreement. In Section 12, then the bioscience corporate minimum fee, if a business's entire payroll and property is inside the zone, they'd be exempt from the minimum fee. That provision is consistent with how the job zone minimum fee exemption works.
Any questions on the body of House File 2552? We will now move to an amendment that the department came to us with yesterday, the AO4-1017 amendment. I will move adoption of the amendment. As many as are in favor of the amendment say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed say no. Motion prevails. Amendment is adopted. Who wants to? I believe there's three sections in this amendment. Who would like to speak to them?
Mr. Chair, are you referring to the AO4-1017?
Yes.
Amendment?
Yes.
That would be me.
Oh, streamline.
That's correct.
Some technical language, Mr. Heck, dealing with streamline. Does the governor know, or should we keep this our little secret? Okay, Mr. Walzer, let's go through it. Section 1.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The first two sections are technical in nature regarding conforming Minnesota law to the language that's contained in the streamlined agreement with the member states. The First Amendment is an amendment to the Commissioner's General Power Statute, which is Section 270.06, to give the Commissioner of Revenue specific authority to negotiate with the other member states as to the amount of the monetary allowance for sellers and certified service providers who buy the software that's necessary to collect the sales taxes. And then the second section in the amendment simply provides for a funding mechanism whereby these sellers or certified service providers can simply deduct these costs from the funds that they collect. The next portion of this amendment is to add a new Article 3 to this policy bill, which deals exclusively with lowering the uniform dollar threshold for which businesses will be required to pay their taxes electronically. Currently, the threshold is $120,000 for most business taxes, and for withholding tax, the threshold is $50,000. This would lower the threshold to $20,000. And the article is effective for payments becoming due in calendar year 2005 based upon tax liabilities incurred in fiscal year ending June 30th of this year.
And Mr. Walzer, has the department done any studies as to the availability of electronic payments for businesses that go down to this size? You know, I can understand why it's convenient for the department. I want to understand, are we putting a new burden on taxpayers?
Mr. Chair, I don't honestly know if such a study has ever been done. My understanding is that the threshold is not going to impact small businesses that much. It might impact medium-sized businesses, but I'm not so sure it's going to affect the ma-and-pa grocery store, you know. But in answer to your question, I don't believe that such a study has ever been done.
Before I recognize Representative Lindner, why $20,000? Where did the number come from?
Mr. Chair, the number is the result of the consensus of all the taxing divisions within the department. This does not apply to individual income tax, so there was a consensus among the sales tax, withholding tax, audit divisions, the corporate franchise tax division. It's not a magic number, but it's a number that the department thought was reasonable and that could work for all the various tax types.
Okay, so I understand, so the committee understands, at the $20,000 level, that would imply a business that would have sales of sales tax related items of roughly $300,000, which may or may not be a lot of sales for some very small business for some businesses. Representative Lindner, then Representative Vanderveer. Representative Lindner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted some clarification on the effective date for this. On page 14, it says December 31st, 2003. Should that have been 2004, or is this retroactive?
Mr. Walzer, let's see when we're in section 3 is. I think Representative Lindner makes a pretty interesting point, is if we pass this, we're putting on a requirement to file electronically effective December 31st, 2003, and these businesses have already made payments this year. Let's hope, right, Representative Nelson?
Mr. Chair, Representative, the section you're looking at is in the next article, which I haven't discussed yet.
Article 4 here.
The section you're looking at has...
Oh, this section, okay. So this section would be applicable, section 1 and 2 and 3 and 4 would be effective on August 1st under this drafting. No, Nina, when would it be effective?
If you look at page 12... Line 26, following of the amendment, effective for payments due in calendar year 2005 and calendar years thereafter based upon liabilities incurred in fiscal year ending June 30th, 2004.
So convenience stores that have $6,000 a week in sales. And I've never been in the convenience store business. I wish former Representative Krause were here. He's in Florida. That doesn't sound like a whole lot of sales to me, but I'm sure we'll hear from the business community. But they would have until next January in order to tool up, am I correct?
Mr. Chair, that is correct.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that to allow something like this in there and then put the onus on some organization or some group of business people to come back and ask us to fix a mistake. This committee has been down that road before. We're still in it now. I think that, for my mind, the answer to your question of why 20,000 is not satisfactory.
I have two responses, Representative Nelson. First, if you want to make a motion to take out the relevant sections, that's certainly in order. And secondly, one of the reasons that we consider bills and lay them over is to give the public on some of this stuff an opportunity to contact us on provisions that may be, how can I put it, a little surprising. And that's where we kind of let them ferment for a while. But if you want to make a motion, Representative Nelson, it's certainly your prerogative to do so, Representative Nelson.
Understood. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And to that point, of laying them over and affording these organizations the opportunity to come and testify on them, getting the word out doesn't necessarily move as fast as a person might want to.
Okay.
And again, I think you've had evidence by that, but I certainly will be offering up that amendment whenever your testifiers are done on this particular issue or whatever time you think is appropriate.
Mr. Nelson, no time like the present.
I will move that we do strike the amendment that is being requested in Article 3 on page 8.
So that would be Article 3. Why don't we let the department finish their testimony on the whole electronic payment issue, and then I will recognize you for a motion, Representative Nelson, if that
yes,
would be
Mr.
okay.
Yes, Mr. Chair, that would be fine.
Representative Vandeveer.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Does the Section 1, Article 3, does that include withholding?
Mr. Walzer.
Mr. Chair, Representative, Section 1 does include withholding. That's correct.
Well, Mr. Chair,
Representative Vandeveer.
It is my intent to move to delete Section 1.
Well, there's two people who want to make motions. I would just point out one of the burdens that you are putting on whenever you do have a e-payment requirement is, I don't know about anybody else's bank. I can only talk about mine. When I make an electronic payment of a certain amount of fund transfer, sometimes I get dinged with a $10 or $15 service charge. And, you know, because of how our sales tax law operates, you're requiring 12 payments a year. The way withholding would work, at least 4 payments a year, if not 12. It depends upon the size of the payroll. I'm just wondering what I don't know what banking relationship businesses have. I can just talk about my relationship. I'm just wondering what sort of burden that this provision would put onto, as I said, a business that would have $6,000 of sales a week, which, you know, could be a bait shop, and the guy lives above, and has a good summer, and all of a sudden has $400,000 worth of sales, may net out of it $40,000, and now the state is, we're not asking them, we're it's appropriate that they pay that the taxes are due, but we're putting a new burden on them. So, Representative Vandeveer.
Well, Mr. Chair, and I do have concerns about just the philosophy of requiring that it be paid electronically. There's equipment purchases involved, and a lot of people do not. They want to write out a check, and I know that this committee in the past hasn't, just from the bills that we passed on the floor, hasn't doesn't necessarily subscribe to it, but I do, and so I would move to delete Article 3, Section 1 from the bill.
If you could withhold on that, because there may be some other sections you're going to want to include in your motion or Representative Nelson P's motion. So let's go through all the new thresholds so that we get them all. Mr. Walzer.
Mr. Chair.
Or is Article 3, is it just delete Article 3 and we've deleted all the electronic payments? Is there anything else in Article 3 we have to worry about, Mr. Manson? Mr. Manson.
Mr. Chairman, if I could just add, we could provide some kind of what the average size business that would be impacted by that lowering of the threshold for e-pay, I know, from both a withholding standpoint and from a sales tax standpoint, if that would be helpful for the committee.
I am inclined to entertain Representative Nelson's motion, and if you can provide me and other committee members with a good reason to do it, we'll certainly, when the omnibus tax bill comes through, have an opportunity to revisit the issue. So I think at this point, Representative Nelson P. and Representative Vanderveer move to strike. Is it the entire Article 3? What about Section 6? Is that a different in Article 3? Is that a kind of a different issue for publicly traded partnerships, Joe?
Yes, that's a federal form. I think that's different.
Oh, so, Joel, how would we affect what Representative Nelson P. and Representative Vanderveer want to do?
Mr. Chairman, what you could do is to delete all of basically delete page 8 starting at line 1 through page 6 line 31. Page 12.
You're good, Joel, but not that good.
Page 12 line 31 through page 12 line 31. That on line 31, that's renumbering the articles because a new article was inserted. I think the section 6 and following, you'll probably want to discuss that separately because there's a sort of a federal conformity issue involved with that.
Representative Nelson P. and Representative Vanderveer move to delete page 8, starting on line 1 or on line 3, Joel.
Line 1.
Line 1? Well, then you have
actually
the
page 7, line 36, too.
Page 7, line 36?
Since that's the insertion.
Okay. Page 7, line 36, through page 12, line 31. As many as are in favor of that motion, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, say no. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Section 6.
Mr. Chair, Section 6 is an amendment to the next article of the policy bill, which is the miscellaneous article. This section has to do with electronic filing as opposed to electronic payment, which we just got through discussing. And basically what this section does, it adopts a federal requirement for partnerships to file their partnership returns electronically with the IRS, so that if they're required to file electronically with the IRS, then they would also be required to file their state partnership returns electronically.
Okay. Now we go on to two amendments that the staff has come with that I believe are very technical in nature. Chair will move amendment H2552A1. As many as are in favor of the amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, say no. Motion prevails. Amendment is adopted. Karen, this is the St. Paul Airport issue that we thought we had solved, and we need a little bit more language to solve it. Am I correct?
Right. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, this comes from the Minneapolis-St. Paul Airport, International Airport, has always been exempt from fiscal disparities. And when we It doesn't have any explicit language in statute that exempts it, but it's always been of the notion that because it's not located in a city or town, it doesn't contribute, because that's how the contribution and distributions and fiscal disparities are made. And so the airport has always been out. In 1996, there was legislation put in the tax bill. It was Representative Mariani's, and it was to put the St. Paul Airport on the same level playing field as the Minneapolis Airport, with the idea that the St. Paul Airport wanted to start competing for some of the business, that they thought that one of their disincentives was that they paid so much more property taxes. And so what the 1996 legislation did is it detached the St. Paul Airport in much the same way that the Minneapolis Airport has always been detached from a city, and so they aren't paying school district taxes or they aren't paying city taxes. When we were updating our databases, and it just happened now this year, we were looking and we came to find that the St. Paul Airport is in fact paying into fiscal disparities. And when we checked with Ramsey County staff, they said, well, you know, there really isn't anything in statute that specifically says that they should be exempt from fiscal disparities. And it's a very small contribution at this point, but the whole intention of the Mariani language back in 96 was to put the two airports on the same level playing field. And so what this language does is it makes it clear that both of those airports are excluded from the area and won't pay into fiscal disparities.
Is there also a little technical thing?
Oh, yes, I'm sorry. On line 13 and 14, that is just a technical correction that the revisor's office asked if we would make that was in the original bill, and we wanted to correct it. You can notice that it just goes from a capital B to a small b, and those two are not related to the airport issue.
Okay. Next, we will go to the A04. Oh, who? What?
Is there anybody?
No, Karen has said that if there's any, I mean, we don't have anybody from the department. This is basically staff-driven, and appears to me, you know, looking around the table, I'm the only one on the committee back then, and I'll tell you that I remember the testimony on this, and it was to exempt the St. Paul Intermediate Airport for fiscal disparities for good or for ill. Okay. Oh, Representative Magnus.
On line 9, I think after constituting a major, it should be and.
No.
Or and.
Should say.
No.
And or? And. And. A D.
Major, a major or.
The spell checker will catch and as a word, but it is not grammatically correct.
Oh, it's, yeah.
Representative Magnus.
A major or, and that and shouldn't be in there.
So just delete that.
Delete the first AN, so it says excluding lands constituting a major or an international airport.
Representative Magnus moves to delete the word AN, first AN on line 9. As many as are in favor say aye. Aye. Those opposed say no. Motion prevails. Amendment is adopted. Next, we will go to the A041009 amendment. I'll move adoption of the amendment. As many as are in favor say aye. Aye. Those opposed say no. Motion prevails. Amendment is adopted. Is this the department or is this Pat? And this is kind of a really interesting glitch. Lance, could you explain it? And we're not doing anything retroactively here, because I know that there's one city that wants us to do it retroactively, but we do have the doctrine of latches, Representative Mullery. You sit on your rights and you cannot exercise them after the time frame has expired. Mr. Sturica.
Mr. Chair, I have the summary in front of me. I don't have the...
This is the population.
Yeah, I don't have the language of the amendment in front of me, but if I have the summary here. We're changing three sections of the law. Minnesota Statute Support, thank you. 47, adding a new section to the, was kind of the metropolitan chapter of the statutes, chapter 473. This new section would formally, in writing, require the Metropolitan Council to produce population and number of household estimates for all the cities and towns in the metro area by June 1st of a year, and give the affected cities and counties, towns,
until June 24th to let the council know that they object to the estimate for one reason or another, and require the council to provide those estimates to the commissioner by July 15th. Right now in law, there's a little cryptic reference to the commissioner using these data that is provided by the council, provided to the commissioner by July 1st. This provides more background into actually requiring the council to do these counts, and we give them, this change would give them another 2 weeks from July 1st to July 15th to get those estimates to the commissioner. That allows a little bit more time to work out any glitches in the numbers between the council and the affected city. The second section, which is labeled Section 5, because that's where we put in, just changes the Metro Fiscal Disparities Law to say that these are the population estimates that we're going to use. Right now, as I said, it's just kind of a cryptic reference to using estimates provided by the council. We're now going to refer back to this first section that provides a more discrete outline of how the process should work. Section 6 does the same thing for local government aids. We use this data computing local government aids. There's just a cryptic reference right now to using the data as provided by July 1st. Again, what we do is refer back to the new section. Sorry, there's not an explicit reference there, but the new section would provide the procedures and dates by which the council would do this, and then give a couple more weeks to allow that process to work itself out before those data become final for local government aid purposes. And importantly, from the department's point of view, on the bottom of page 2, lines 35 and 36, and on the top of page 3, we are going to say that those data become final for local government aid purposes on July 15th. So even if the council in some city or town is working out some issue related to the estimates, we have to move forward with the aid process so we can certify aid so the local units can set their budgets and so on and so forth. So this provides in law a clear indication that these data will become final for aid purposes on July 15th. And this is effective the day following final enactment, so it's moving forward and does not affect any computations or certifications in the past.
Representative Broad.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe you can help me out with what the state demographer does versus the Metropolitan Council. I'm wondering if we're setting populations for aid in rural Minnesota by a different agency than we're setting populations in Metro Minnesota. I'm confused about how those work together.
Well, before I recognize, I think Pat Dalton can help on this, but we've always done it that way. With Metropolitan Council setting the population for cities in the metropolitan area to state demographer out state, and there was a glitch for one city that when they got what their local government aid was going to be, they were very unhappy and wanted a change in November. And we weren't going, and they wanted a ex post facto law to do it. We were obviously not going to do that, but it appeared that this entire section needed some work that Pat could do answer Representative Broad's question thoroughly.
Mr. Chair, Representative Broad, the way the demographer's authority has always been written is that they do the estimates for the local governments that the Met Council doesn't do. The only direct admonition in law to the Met Council right now was the provision in the fiscal disparities law that said that they had to do it for cities and townships in the Met Council. The demographer has always had essentially drop-dead dates of when they had to certify to towns, when towns or cities had to protest their estimation, and you know when things kind of became final. And because none of that was ever addressed directly in the Met Council provision, what happened was when this metropolitan city came actually in September and said, we don't like our number and we think, you know, it should be changed because that will change our LGA calculation, there were no real drop-dead dates for the Met Council. So essentially what this does is it puts the Met Council on roughly the same footing as the demographer, although it does give the Met Council
slightly more time to do it than the demographer has for outstate Minnesota.
Representative Bryan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I don't have a problem with the dates. I think the dates are good. Does the Met Council and the state demographer use the same, I don't know if it's a statistical analysis or whatever, in terms of how they do their projections and their estimations?
Mr. Chair, Representative Broad, my understanding is yes, they actually work very closely together.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And continuing on that same vein, Ms. Dalton, educate me, please. I would presume that the state demographer starts with the 10-year U.S. census and then does the estimates beyond that. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, both the state demographer and the Met Council start with the census data and then do their estimates based on some additional data that they get both from the federal government and from local sources.
If I could continue. Then, given if you start with the wrong number, you're going to continue for 10 years with wrong information. And to that point, then, is there an appeal process similar to this for outstate Minnesota?
Ms. Walton.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, yes, there is an appeal process for outstate Minnesota. The dates are May 1st and June 10th and July 1st. But they're roughly, you know, they've got about the same amount of time. In addition, a city or town can always, if they are totally in disagreement with either the demographer or the Met Council, and they can't reach resolution on this number, they can actually pay to have a special census done. And then the demographer or the Met Council would have to recognize that going forward. There's also, within the federal census, cities and towns and counties had an opportunity during the federal census to protest their population.
Mr. Chairman, they had that in theory only. In practice, absolutely not.
Representative Vandeveer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, what happens if they disagree now?
Ms. Dalton.
Mr. Chair, Representative Vandeveer, I really wish there was somebody either. There is. The state demographer and Bill Byers from the Met Council are here.
Oh.
We should have them.
Gillespie, you're hiding. You're in disguise.
You know, actually, this is an area in which you guys in greater Minnesota get a real price break. And let me explain. The state budget pays for the demographer's office. It's the local property tax which pays for the Met Council GS&A in which their GIS function is. Representative Nelson.
Not to debate with the knowledgeable chair, but I'll use the city of Lindstrom.
Yeah.
And I'll use the U.S. Census of 1990.
I'm not going to defend that, Mr.
That's right.
You know better than that.
And we certainly took a hit that in population that equaled that in LGA. We lost about 1.5 years worth of LGA over that 10-year period of time total because of underpopulation counts.
Mr. Gillespie, how could you do that, knowing that Mr. Nelson was
going to get... He did not, Mr. Chair. The U.S. government did. So.
You could have helped. Mr. Gillespie, you could have helped. You should have helped. If only you would know. Mr. Gillespie, welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself with the table.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Tom Gillespie, and I'm the Minnesota State Demographer with the State Department of Administration. Basically what this language would do would be essentially bring the timelines for the estimating process into accord between the Metropolitan Council and the state demographer estimates. There would still be some difference in dates of timing, but there would now be the Met Council would have deadlines that specific statutorily required deadlines that each year that the non-metropolitan the cities outside the seven county area have been in accordance with for two decades now. We do work with absolutely an advocacy role for the state with the Census Bureau. They don't always listen, but we do work with the Census Bureau in trying to correct any kind of errors that have been made. In fact, we just finished a process of count review corrections, and one of the questions I have is a very much of a technical question regarding the bottom of page 2 and top of page 3 is if there were a correction in the census, would that be allowed as opposed to a population estimate correction, and other changes such as annexation, detachment, or dissolutions. Since I haven't seen this language before, I don't know how that would be affected. But if a city were to dissolve itself, would it still receive local government aid because of
only if they belong to the coalition, Mr. Wesley.
Or if they're chiseling.
Only if they still have a bill outstanding to Flaherty and Butch will they get LGA.
We have worked and continue to work in a professional cordial relationship with the Metropolitan Council over time, and my colleague Bill Byers is here with me.
Mr. Byers, welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the tape.
I'm Bill Byers, Research Manager at the Metropolitan Council. As I understood part of the question would be how do we resolve differences? Was it with cities versus the council, or the state versus the cities?
Representative,
not necessarily how do you, just the fact that there's a vehicle in place for cities to do that. I think it's pretty new news to many of 837 outstate cities. So.
Well, in the metro area, that we do what Tom does, work with Tom's staff to work with the Census Bureau to get those numbers as correct as possible. When we get questions with our estimates, my staff goes out and works with the cities, looks at what their development has been, looks at how they've grown, what kind of population per household, things like that. So it's an interactive process. We go back and forth with cities to examine the additional information they bring to us to help do their estimates. So that's the way we work with that process.
Okay, well, what I would suggest is for the department and for our staff to work on this language, because we are asking Mr. Gillespie's office and Mr. Byers' office, they may have informally had this authority in the past, but we're codifying it to a larger extent and codifying an appeals process, which deals with the amount of aid that a city gets, which is a pretty important thing for a lot of cities. So it would seem to me that because this language is now out there, and we probably have a few weeks until we're going to kick a bill out, it would seem that it would be incumbent upon the department to work with the affected agencies and make sure that they're comfortable with the language. I view it more as a technical issue than a policy issue. But I would prefer to settle the issue this year rather than have the department come back with more language next year saying that this solution didn't work. So does that satisfy some of your concerns, Representative Nelson?
It does, Mr. Chairman. I think to that point, I quickly spin back to a year ago when we worked with Department of Revenue and they put in place, for lack of better terms, some educational tools for the different tax review boards of cities, townships, etc. And I know that the Department of Revenue has their regular tax sales tax updates that go on, but I think that from time to time we know that all of the players in these units of government, be they appointed / hired or they're elected, they're going to change the roles quite a few times, and we're all ignorant. It's just about different subjects, and I think it's an opportune time for departments to work at a policy to educate on an ongoing basis. Thank you.
Well, I see Mr. Folkman and Mr. Mossman in the gallery, and I think what Mr. Nelson, Representative Nelson, is saying is that you mail things all the time to cities and counties from the department's property tax division,
And, you know, we will be doing something in this area. Obviously, the old law is a mess. But I think that Representative Nelson makes a very good point that good information as to what the appeals process is in this area and how to work with either the Met Council or the demographer probably will vet a lot of the frustration that sometimes a mayor or a council or a manager has, and they don't think that they have any options. That would just be my observation. With that, we'll see the rest of you on Tuesday, and we're going to lay the bill over as amended for further consideration, possible including the omnibus tax bill. We'll tell the Democrats that we're meeting Monday, and we'll surprise them when we're all not here. Meeting's adjourned.